This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The group Voters Not Politicians wants to change the process for drawing the boundaries for congressional and state legislative districts in Michigan. The group is holding a town hall meeting in Kalamazoo on Sunday. Coming up, we'll talk with Voters Not Politicians campaign leader Katie Fahey. But first, criminal justice reform is a hot topic right now, nationally and in Michigan. If prison sentences are going to be shorter, what happens when felons are released? In particular, can they find jobs? Battle Creek Inquirer reporter Dylan Davis examined this issue and spoke with some men in Southwest Michigan who are now looking for a second chance after prison. Dylan Davis, thank you for being here.
Hey, good morning, Gordon. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. What interested you in this story?
I saw Samuel Hunter speak in October of last year through something called Bridges of Cultural Understanding, which is a program of the Battle Creek Community Foundation. And it's a group of a couple of people that put on kind of informative panels and this sort of thing. And Chris Walden of Michigan Works put on Samuel, somebody who he had worked with at Michigan Works. And he put him on, and Samuel just got up in front of this room and just told his story about how, as a young person had grown up in Detroit, he was running a gang, and he had burned someone's house down, and mistakenly, you know, they didn't realize there were two people inside, and they both died as a result of it, you know, and he ended up in jail for almost 25 years, and, you know, now he's out, and he's in the into the workforce, and but, it, you know, it's kind of a lengthy road for him, and I just kind of hearing the way that he spoke, and, you know, just the some of the topics he hit on, I felt that there was some room to write on the subject, so I got in touch with him probably the following week, and we've been working on it, you know, roughly since then. So
you've talked with him and some other people as well for this story. If you can kind of draw a bit of a picture for our audience, if you are someone who is out in the world, but you have a criminal record, how tough is it for you to then find a job?
I think there's a sense of people feeling they get sentenced again after they're out of prison, you know, because after these people end up in these long sentences, you know, whether it be 5, 10, 20 years, you know, you go in there and you're kind of away from the world. Most prisons have a kind of a varying degree of success with educating and opening up programs that, you know, that can help their, you know, their inmates. So when you get out, you're kind of left to your own devices as to getting in the room and get a job when you get out. And, you know, it tends to be when you have that felony record, it tends to be a little bit disqualifying for you.
And are there certain characteristics of someone who is in prison beyond the fact that they have a criminal record, certain things that they're likely to share in terms of their education that might also be in the way, even if they didn't have a criminal record to present before an employer?
There's a number of programs that can work within prison. One of the ones that Samuel did was based off a Detroit nonprofit called Chance for Life, which encourages inmates to kind of teach each other life skills, different educational concepts, and try to prepare them to be on the outside. And the guy that runs that runs an employment agency, you know, so he's able to kind of work with some of these people and place them once they get out if that's what they want to do. You know, so it provides avenues of education that they might not otherwise get. In Samuel's case, he educated himself a good deal while he was in there. He kind of he reached a point where he was burying himself in the law library and getting involved in just a number of programs while he was in there, just because he had a lot of time in there, and he wanted to be able to get out. And I think that's the case for a lot of people.
And a lot of these people, when they go in, they're going in without a lot of formal education, mm-hmm. correct?
Yeah. The numbers show that. You know, that high school education or less is the majority. I mean, that's the common demographic.
So some of these men, including Samuel, have been able to find employment after prison. How did that happen for them?
I think it's a case by case basis for most people. And I think there really is no clear path, and which is part of the reason why I wanted to write about this subject, because I just think, you hear about the workforce shortage here in, you know, West Michigan and Michigan, and you see this concentration of people that are leaving and are unable to get a job, or unable to even get in the room to discuss their qualifications for that job. And Samuel's case, he got an opportunity when he came out through a group run by Dale Boyer in Battle Creek, where you kind of do some handyman work. You power wash houses and do roofs, and kind of wherever your skill set naturally is, that's kind of what you do. And it just took a long time to get the opportunity. He finally got a job at WKW Roof Rail Systems. And, you know, when they closed, he moved over to Bowers Manufacturing here in Portage. You know, and he's seen himself kind of move up the ladder because he's, you know, he's in his 40s and he, you know, and he's very well spoken and he's a natural leader. So, you know, that's how it worked for him. But the path isn't always so clear.
Are there certain employers who seem a little more willing to entertain the idea that they might hire someone who's now out of prison to work for them?
This was something I found that was kind of interesting in this story, and I guess I didn't really touch on it too much. I'd called around to some employers in Battle Creek and Calhoun County, and I didn't get a ton of responses on this subject, even from people that I have pretty good source relationships with. And I think it's because they're uncomfortable. I think it's hard to draw a line in the sand and say, yes, we most definitely hire felons. I think it's a hard thing, because I think for most of them, it's case by case. At the very best, it's case by case of, you know, what was your felony? How long are you in there? What are your qualifications? You know, it was kind of odd, though. I didn't get a ton of response on that. And, you know, there's, you know, certainly something to follow up on that in for a future story, I think.
And there certainly would be some risk on the employer side here. There's, you know, if someone has been in for a crime which involved, you know, theft, you have to think about, you know, what could happen to your business. You don't have to think about the safety of other employees if someone has been in for a violent crime.
Sure. I mean, and how many human resources departments are, you know, equipped to judge whether someone's reformed? You know, who has the ability within your department to determine, you know, what a person is saying is true, and that, you know, that what they learned and while they were incarcerated, you know, that has led them to a place where they are reformed and they're, you know, they're ready to get to work. I think that some people aren't able to do that. And, you know, I think that comes off generally as a kind of an unwillingness to do it because it's difficult to do.
You tell us about a group in Battle Creek, the Otis Group. Now, what do they do involving ex-felons and trying to find places where they can land a job?
This group is run by BD Alexander, and he does a lot of things. He's a young guy here in Battle Creek, and he does a ton of things. Like he's on the BC Vision Steering Committee, run by the Kellogg Foundation, obviously, and he writes to these felons. He writes to them and tries to understand their story and tries to see where they're at. And he's got this thick binder full of their stories. You know, it's people saying, hey, I didn't think anybody cared about me out there. I didn't, you know, I don't know what I want to do, or I want to do this. How do I get there? And he tries to at least have conversations with them and try to provide them avenues where when you get out, take a look at this, you know, take a look at this. And, you know, and, you know, maybe even link some of their family members to these opportunities ahead of their release. So it kind of gives them a better opportunity.
Now, one of the things that might get someone an opportunity is if they don't have to tell right up front that they have a criminal record.
Sure.
This is known as the ban the box idea. Eventually, an employer is going to know about this information, but they don't necessarily have to know right away.
Right.
Does that seem to at least open the door a little bit for someone with a criminal record?
The researchers I've talked to for this story said yes, that it does open the door. It's you know, as I said, that having a felony conviction on your record tends to be disqualifying. I mean, so many people won't even get a chance to get in the room to plead their case and sell themselves. You know, some of the people I talked in the story are great salesmen of themselves. They can tell about you know, what their capability is. With a lot of people, the opportunity just isn't there because you know every application that you have has a mark. You know, have you had a felony? Have you had a felony within 5 years, 10 years? You know, and then you have to check yes, and you know it tends to, your application tends to end up in the circular file. You know, they just they'll call you back, and you know, and the position gets filled, and you don't get an interview.
And just to be clear here, if you talk about banning the box, that would not be there.
Sure.
No one has ever suggested that I've talked to that an employer should not know at some point about someone's criminal record. The idea is simply that you don't have to find out until you're getting close to a decision.
Ban the box simply just delays when an employer will know that information. You know, generally that might be something that you would discuss during the interview, or if you get a second interview, it's an opportunity to kind of talk about your background and, you know, and help them understand that, yeah, you know, maybe I did something horrible in the past, but, you know, I've paid for that and I'm ready to get out and do something different. You know, and the researchers I talked to said that, you know, Ban the Box does have its successes and its shortcomings, but, you know, they think overall they're for it. And they think that it's something that, you know, counties and states should give a look to.
One of the shortcomings being that even if you don't have a box there, you still have to fill out an employment history.
Sure.
And if there is a decades-long gap, that is going to set off alarm bells for most people who are making a hiring decision.
Jennifer Cobina, who I talked to at Michigan State University, she's a researcher on this topic. She had talked about employers will look at other things, look at a gap in a job history. They'll look at a gap of qualified references. You know, they won't, you know, they don't have somebody that, you know, an employer to call and say, hey, how's this person work? They, you know, they just don't have that. And it tends to skew against younger black males because people will, you know, they even look at a name. You know, they'll look at a name and say, you know, they start to make assumptions about, is this person a felon? Is this person, what is this person's background? Because they're not able to ask up front. They're not able to immediately disqualify you. So in a way, they discriminate against you, and then you're disqualified in another way. So, you know, her research, some of the ones that's out there, say that is what happens.
So there might be some form of profiling going on, even if you're not asking the very explicit question up front.
Sure. I think most of the people I talk to will say that they are for it, but also caution you that it's not the complete answer to the solution. I mean, to the problem. I mean, but it gives you a chance, and it gives people like Samuel a chance to get in the room, and you kind of hear his baritone voice, and you kind of hear it, and you know, pretty soon, you know, you're like, man, this, I could see a fit for this guy. I could see him in a leadership role, and that's what he's doing. So, you know, I think that's the chance that you take.
So when you talk to Samuel and you talk to some of the other people that you've met in Southwest Michigan who are either currently holding jobs or maybe are looking for employment, what do you hear from them about the opportunity that they want to have and the opportunity that they see for employment with a criminal record?
So many of the people I talk to, they got out of prison, and they just, I think you're just quickly looking for an avenue. You're looking for something. You're looking for a chance. You know, and if you've gotten educated in prison and you've gotten, you know, you kind of know what you're looking for, but the chances, I mean, there's things like someone said about a smartphone. It's like, I was in prison for 18 years. I didn't have a smartphone. I don't know what that is. You know, I don't really know how to type that well, you know? So it's you have to, outside of just having the natural things that are going to keep you from the job, there's just technological things and skill sets that you might not have because you had no reason to acquire it. You were incarcerated. So, you know, a lot of these guys, you know, they come out and they, you know, like Samuel, he buried himself at Michigan Works. You know, for Brian X, Antony's Gant Bay. I mean, they found other avenues to try to get into work. You know, it was college for some. It was working at a restaurant for a time. You know, just trying to get an opportunity. And you know, the ones I talked to found that opportunity. But I think too often, you know, you just don't. The opportunity doesn't always present itself. Not for a long time.
You open this article with a question for Samuel Hunter that you come back around to. What would your mother think of you now? What does he say to that, if you can maybe summarize it for us, in terms of, you know, how he views that relationship with his mother, which I think also gives us a window into how he sees himself at this age?
You know, I lost my own mother in 2015, you know, so it was something that I think you're always mindful of the person, you know, people's relationships with whoever was their mentor, whoever their, you know, the parental figure is. And, you know, Samuel lost his mother while he was in prison. She came and visited him in 1995, right around Valentine's Day, February the 11th. And she dropped off some clothes that would need to be checked and, you know, and just saw him and said, hey, we're thinking about you. And then February the 14th, she passed away. So, you know, his last, and because they are of the Muslim faith, you know, he wasn't able to get out of prison. You know, he probably would have been granted a temporary release to go to her services, but, you know, because of the mandates of the religion, you have to be buried within 24 hours, and 24 hours is just not enough to get out of jail. So, you know, he knows that when she visited him, it would be the last time that she would. You know, and then a few days later, he got a letter from her, and then, you know, a day or two after that, he got the box of clothes, and you know, that's all you have left of your mom, you know, and he's looking at that point of 1995 of still a very lengthy sentence of almost 20 more years in prison for what he did. And, you know, he'll tell you that's, you know, he started to feel something right around then. He started to feel that, you know, maybe this isn't what I want to do. I think, you know, he started to find this programming, started to find an avenue out. And, you know, when we talked about his mother, you know, he pulled out the photo of her. You know, and he's got a little picture book of her, and you know, and he's just, and I'm friends with him on Facebook now, and you see he's got a photo, and everyone's like, man, I miss her, and you know, you can see that it meant a lot to him to, you know, to pay tribute to her, and give an opportunity to make himself better, you know. So that was kind of the premise of why I came back to that question.
Dylan Davis, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
You can find Dylan Davis's story on ex-felons looking for employment in the Battle Creek Inquirer at battlecreekinquirer.com. There's also a link at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. What determines who represents you in Congress or the state legislature? Of course, the votes cast on Election Day. But which voters make up a district? Right now, the lines go through the legislative process. After they're passed by the House and Senate, they're signed into law by the governor. But there are some calls to change that system. Katie Fahey is the campaign leader of Voters Not Politicians. The group is holding a town hall meeting Sunday afternoon at First Congregational Church in Kalamazoo. Katie Fahey, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What is Voters Not Politicians?
Voters Not Politicians is a ballot committee for the state of Michigan. It's a group of citizens who have come together who have said we'd like to amend our state constitution to create a new system for how our districts that you were mentioning are drawn, and how removing essentially the politicians who are currently in office and who have potentially something to gain from that system not changing away from that process and bringing it back to the people to be deciding those things.
Well, you touched on it there, but give us more of an idea of what is wrong with the current system for how district boundaries are drawn.
Yeah, so really there's a conflict of interest that is just inherent to the process that we currently have. The politicians who are in office are getting to decide how these district lines are drawn. It's a closed process. There is no mandatory public feedback, and there is no really outside of currently elected officials involved in that process. And so what we see is that, you know, there is a gamesmanship that really happens throughout this process in trying to figure out how can it become easier for one of the two major parties to get more guaranteed, quote unquote, seats than the other by kind of moving around demographics and where city boundaries are, and deciding which communities they would like to have within their own representation to make it most likely easier for them to get more total House and Senate seats for our state.
So if the legislature and elected leaders are not going to draw these lines, what are some other ways that it might be done?
Yeah, great question. So really, there's a couple other ways. There's other states who have been doing this. There's about nine that have a commission, and that means an independent commission, so kind of removed from current legislators. You could have it like a random draw of citizens, kind of like a jury system that we have, where anybody who is registered to vote and maybe met some different criteria could go on to there. You could have it so that you had individuals from particular political parties assess number of seats and an application process for people to get on, and you'd either have a judge or a state auditor or some department that made kind of those interview decisions. You could take, you know, other already currently elected officials and put them on there. We joke around that we should take the U of M and MSU football coaches, who are some of the top paid public servants in Michigan, and have them, you know, be in a room and fight it out to see how the line should be drawn. But there's a lot of different ways that don't have to be directly tied to current legislators.
As of now, your group has not settled on any one method, correct?
Yeah, correct.
Are you then considering a whole array, including the ones that you just mentioned?
We are. Part of these town halls, the biggest thing, well, there were two main reasons we wanted to hold them. One was to kind of get the state talking about redistricting reform and what that would mean and what gerrymandering is, which is the, you know, political gain of political influence kind of taking over how these lines are drawn. And the second part was really to gather policy feedback to see and truly have a solution for what we all think is fair, what we think would be an appropriate way to be deciding how our representative democracy looks like in Michigan. And so anybody who comes out to these town halls will receive a survey that goes over some of these important questions, including how is the commission drawn, who can be on the commission, what's the criteria that should be being used for these maps, what type of data should or shouldn't be used. And there's some online meetings as well that people are more than welcome to join if they cannot make it out to one of our locations across the state.
How much do you think you can actually remove politics from the drawing of district lines? Because it is inherently, in many ways, a political question, and political parties have a very vested interest in how those lines end up looking.
Yeah, so although they do have a strong interest because it makes it cheaper and more easy to be reelected, this does not have to be a political party process. It can just be a reflection of our Michigan people. And in other states, what you see is they'll put strict kind of restrictions on the types of data that can be used to draw these maps. So in Iowa, they actually only look at population numbers. And then they have the commission hold meetings in each of the proposed districts to gather feedback on whether people think some of the lines should be adjusted based on, you know, something a computer couldn't pick up, such as communities that would normally do business together, let's say, that would it would make sense to have a similar representative. So, for example, maybe Lansing and East Lansing or, you know, Grand Rapids and East Grand Rapids are different, you know, things that a computer can't necessarily know going into it. But because you can start affecting the type of data that's looked at, you really get more control so that, you know, these maps have some kind of system that it can be tested against. So that if you create standards and you create different criteria and you rank that criteria, you should be able to replicate those results, kind of like in a, you know, scientific survey. If you can replicate those results, then you know that that criteria was truly followed. Right now in Michigan, we do not have a system set up like that. We do not know what kind of data is used to draw these maps because it's a closed process. And there are consultants who are paid lots of money from political parties to help ensure that, you know, political gain, because it is part of passing agendas on both sides of the aisle.
Greg McNeely, a conservative operative, wrote in the Detroit News recently about some of the restrictions which are in place, the things that are currently in the law. The districts must be compact and connected. They're explicitly required to be drawn to conform to the Voting Rights Act. County boundaries must be respected. Those are some of the things. If a county line must be broken, the fewest number of full cities or townships possible must be shifted. Do you think all of those things should still be part of the process? And if they are, does that perhaps limit some of the ability to draw new lines in a way that, that may be more politically balanced, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, well, so although some of that is in the law, the way it is defined has some different interpretation. And I would argue that, you know, the reason we see a lawsuit potentially being drawn in Michigan against the current maps is because we feel like those rules have not been followed how they were supposed to be. I think we would include some of that criteria, maybe even make it more strict and put again some restrictions on the other data that can be used in regards to drawing these maps, because it does go beyond census. It does go beyond city limits, and trying the more we can define it, even though it takes a longer process and, you know, it kind of adds to some of the confusion about talking about all of this, the more we can try and create a system that is, you know, less likely to be corrupted and that is truly more reflective of people. If you look at the map, I encourage everybody to go online and look at, you know, our state congressional, Senate, and House maps and look and see if you think that they are compact shapes, because you will not see that. And if you talk to people in these town halls and we kind of ask about the local area and what people think, I mean, it's very clear that there's some manipulation going on that is not looking after keeping our communities together.
You've mentioned that there are other states which have done some form of redistricting reform. Does any one state stand out to you as having really got it right or has really reformed the process? Maybe it wouldn't work in Michigan because we're different states, but is there a state that stands out to you which really changed its process and made it significantly better?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple. One that comes to mind, it was led by the Republican effort, actually, Arnold Schwarzenegger over in California. They did a pretty big overhaul. I think they're, you know, still analyzing the results. The things with redistricting reform is because redistricting happens every 10 years after the census. Even as some of these changes have happened, we only have one or two election cycles to really be analyzing the data to see, you know, how effective or not effective is this new process. But they have a commission that's made up of citizens. They do require that you register whatever party you want to vote for. So whether that's Democrat, Republican, or independent. In Michigan, we do not have that. But it's essentially a random draw with an application process to fill those seats. And it's citizen-led. They have to hold public hearings across the state to hear public feedback. And they seem to have a system that at least is getting raising satisfaction of the people of California. And that's important, too, because when you have officials who, you know, aren't as responsive to the people, then we aren't getting decisions or laws passed that people want, which is, again, the whole point of kind of this representative democracy that we have. So I would suggest, yeah, checking out California, but there's definitely other models out there. I think Michigan would need its own unique solution, though, especially with us not having people register what party they're voting for.
Does your group have a timeline for coming up with a proposal and submitting language for petitions? Of course, that's got to be approved before you can actually start collecting signatures. But do you have a date yet by which you want to have a proposal that you can submit to the state?
Yeah, our timeline. So throughout March and the first week of April, we'll be gathering feedback at these town halls. The policy feedback is really important. We'll be holding a policy summit with our policy team and then they'll be kind of working and crafting language throughout the end of April, potentially beginning of May. And we hope to submit our ballot to the Board of Canvassers sometime in May. And I do want to put out there, too, that anybody who wants to be a part of that process, we have three kind of basic requirements. One, that you're representing yourself and not private interests. Two, that you can stick with a nonpartisan solution so that you can advocate for something that's not going to disenfranchise any other voter based on their political party. And three, that, you know, within this process, we're respecting privacy and confidentiality, especially as we're receiving some of this data and those kinds of things. So we're aiming for, you know, early May to submit our language. But there's a couple other factors. We want to make sure we have the right language and something that'll be really ready to be submitted and that will produce, you know, a new way of doing things that is in line with our Michigan state constitution.
Do you think it is important to be on the ballot in 2018 so that what you put forward can get in place, assuming voters approve it, before the 2020 census?
Yes, we do. In other states, we've seen that really to start raising awareness about this issue, that a ballot drive is a very effective way of doing that and getting people to understand how voting isn't the only way that we can really affect change, that by looking at our entire system in Michigan, we can see, can we be getting more responsive government? More transparent government. I think Michigan's been rated, you know, not as transparent in a couple of different studies comparing different states. And so this is one of those ways that we can start to do that. And what we've seen in other states, there's a lot of power to be lost by especially removing this system from those currently elected who have a lot to gain. And so if you're removing that power, there's going to be unhappy people and a lot of challenges. In other states, we've seen many court challenges go against any kind of citizen-led drive to change the system. And this gives us time, again, to be finding the most effective solution for our state.
Katie Fahey, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Katie Fahey is leading the campaign for Voters Not Politicians. The group is holding a town hall meeting Sunday afternoon at First Congregational Church in Kalamazoo. You can find links with more details at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.